friend of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom.
Diverse runt D-dagen. Här är från maj, juni 1994, 50 år efter D-dagen.
Den 6 juni är det 50 år sedan de allierade inledde invasionen i Normandie, det som var början till slutet på andra världskriget. Invasionen kostade tiotusentals unga män livet, och i den här veckan så vallfärdar många av deras överlevande kamrater, nu gamla män, till Frankrike för att delta i de minnesceremonier som förbereds längs hela kusten.
Just how much I miss you.
And the feelings right now is nostalgic, you know. It's a nostalgic feeling. How come I'm alive?
Bara under de första dagarna av invasionen av Normandikusten för 50 år sedan så dog 10 000 unga män. Pojkar som inte fyllt 20 år, som dittills inte satt sin fot utanför Montana eller Iowa. De visste knappt vem Hitler var, och de hade dittills aldrig sett någon dödas.
I don't want to tell you, but boy, our pants were wet.
Hitler hade lagt under sig Polen, Tjeckoslovakien, Österrike, och Frankrike, Holland, Belgien, Danmark, Norge var ockuperade. Nu eller aldrig måste Hitler stoppas på fastlandet. Offensiven utgick från England mot Normandie natten till den 6 juni 1944 med soldater från 12 länder inblandade. Allra först säkrades bron vid floden Arn, alldeles bredvid ett café där det ser nästan likadant ut idag. Där landsattes engelsmän i en våghalsig landning med glidflygplan vid midnatt.
And it was vital that we held these bridges for 12 hours for the reinforcements that were coming in on the invasion.
Arlette Gondré var den första som befriades, då bara 4 år och dotter till kaféägaren. Familjen väcktes av ett kraftigt brak.
So my mother took me out of the bed in my nightie, in a warm bed, and took me downstairs, and that was quite frightening because I didn't know what was happening, and perhaps it was the Germans.
Inte förrän en engelsk kapten tog sig in i kaféet så förstod familjen vad som var på gång.
But as my mother was embracing them, I realized it was okay, and then it was a great embrace, and I was given some chocolates and some biscuits, and it was a wonderful moment that there they had come, and we would be free.
Kaféägaren Arlettes pappa blev så till sig att han grävde upp champagnen från 1926 som han hade gömt i trädgården och bjöd britterna. Tyskarna hade förstått att invasionen var att vänta någon av de närmaste dagarna, men de var övertygade om att den skulle komma vid Calais, där kanalen är som smalast. Och inte ens när invasionen verkligen hade börjat och Hitler fick rapport om det, så kunde han tro annat än att vara fråga om ett ganska litet och begränsat anfall. Men det skulle ta ytterligare ett år innan kriget tog slut. Ett år då sjukvården Leon av judisk börd började ana den verkliga omfattningen av Hitlers gärning. Sjukvårdaren som måste vårda också de sårade fienderna.
Every time I picked up a German wounded guy, I had a German wounded guy go to, you know, take him to the rear on a litter. Before I treat him, I tell him I was Jewish. And boy, his hands just shook like that.
9 maj 1945 slutade världskriget. En dag som Madame Le Baron aldrig glömmer, för då släpptes äntligen hennes man efter 5 år som krigsfånge hos tyskarna.
En très très grande émotion. Et surtout ma petite fille disant à sa grand-mère, il y a un monsieur avec maman. Là c'est ça fait mal un petit peu quand même.
Nu förbereds 50-årsjubileet av D-dagen den 6 juni. För Madame Le Baron, Arlette Gondré och Leon Smiles, så blev den dagen livsavgörande. Ingen av dem har heller än idag helt försonats med tyskarna. Men det gäller faktiskt inte för fransmännen i allmänhet.
Je ne parle pas de l'allemand parce que les Allemands ne sont pas responsables. C'est, à mon avis, c'est comme dans beaucoup de pays, c'est un parti fanatisé.
You'll never know if you don't.
Femtio år har gått sedan D-dagen. Vad kommer tyskarna ihåg från D-dagen? Juni 1994.
In Germany it's a bitter memory, as CNN's Walter Rogers reports from Berlin.
Germans can but remember the horrible legacy of World War II while the Allies celebrate in Normandy. The death, the destruction, the naked terror of being bombed day and night, the guilt of the Holocaust, and finally 6.5 million of their own dead, Germans killed in that war. At age 15, Helmut Ruhing was yanked out of school and forced to man a German anti-aircraft gun.
And in those days, Germans were longing for only one thing. Let's get it to an end, no matter how. And on top of that, we even knew that Germany had started it all.
Fearing the advancing Soviet army, some German troops, indeed many Germans, quietly cheered when the Allies landed on D-Day.
It was high time that the Americans and French and British came over, so that they were nearer to Berlin before the Russians came on.
By night and day, German cities were bombed by the British and Americans.
Immediately we realized aircraft are approaching. Everyone got stiff with fright. You could do nothing against you. You sat there trapped in a cellar underneath a house.
They had almost no food, and no German who survived the bombing of Berlin will ever forget.
Afterwards, there was this air raid smell all over the city, and this smell of rain on top of burning houses. This is a kind of a smell I shall never forget.
And there was the smell of death.
In those days, people who have killed, who have been killed in action, had to be buried right away. And so my mother, she buried my father all alone by herself.
Walk the streets of Berlin even today. Talk to the women who survived. They too were victims of the war.
I was raped by the Russians so badly I had to later abort two children in the fifth month of pregnancy. After that, I could never have children. They raped my mother too, threw her in a ditch and told me she was dead.
Maria Holznagel is now 84, but she says, we will never forget. We have lived through too much. We have experienced too much. After wars, when the winners celebrate and build themselves memorials, the losers can only take cold comfort in the last bitter lines from Lear. The oldest hath borne the most. We that are young shall never see so much nor live so long. Walter Rogers, CNN, Berlin.
...1994, 50 år efter, besök i Normandie och Benoville med det berömda kaféet vid Pegasus Bridge. Det är ägarinnan som heter Arlette Gondré, som 1944 var en liten dotter i huset. Det var för övrigt det huset som först befriades av alla hus på Normandikusten. Vi hör också några engelska, före detta engelska soldater.
J'ai eu très peur parce que maman m'a pris dans ses bras d'un seul coup dans ma chemise de nuit et m'a descendu à la cave, une cave noire, froide, et bien sûr nous pensions que les Allemands venaient nous chercher.
Arlette Gondré var bara 4 år på dagen D. Idag är hon närmast en krigshistorisk superkändis, intervjuad av tidningar och tv-bolag från alla världens hörn. Alla vill de träffa flickan som blev soldaternas egen lilla maskot.
Ils m'ont donné du chocolat, ils m'ont donné des biscuits et c'était vraiment un moment unique, un moment de joie mais aussi un moment de crainte parce que nous pensions que les Allemands nous peut-être viendraient nous chercher.
Och fortfarande händer det faktiskt att Arlette får besök av just dem som befriade henne och hennes familj.
Oh yes, I remember it very well. Yes, when we barged in here and she was down in the cellar and they found out that it was the British that had landed. Her father and mother brought them up here and we met Arlette and her sister Georgette and one or two of the soldiers gave them some bars of chocolate.
Leslie Chamberlain är pensionerad brevbärare, men framförallt en av D-dagens verkliga hjältar. Tillsammans med den berömde Major Howard var han ombord på det allra första glidflygplanet som tog mark här vid Pegasusbron. I regn, blåst och kolmörker klockan 16 minuter efter midnatt den 6 juni 1944. En scen som både blivit bok och film, och en scen som också dagens soldater vill höra om igen.
All around there, we went straight through it and stopped here, and it's been measured since.
To come here at just after midnight in complete darkness, and to land down there about 80 or 90 mile an hour, back there, and to barge through, and he'd been asked, had the pilot, to put him within 50 meters of the bridge, and to stop here, that was brilliant in itself. Never mind what we had to do when we got here.
Han står vid minnesmärket över sin egen världsberömda insats, men särskilt hjältemodig kände han sig inte.
I was scared. And if anybody tells you they weren't, they're telling stories.
Men på måndag ska hjältarna firas. Då ska Leslie Chamberlain flygas i ärevarv i helikopter. Då kommer kungligheter, presidenter och premiärministrar från hela världen hit till Normandie. Gigantiska paradläktare monteras upp. TV-satelliter installeras överallt. Krigsminnena målas om. Och nya blommor planteras längs stränderna. Det pyntas och det fejas. Allt ska vara klart för en invasion som blir långt större än den för 50 år sedan. Och fundera inte på att ta er hit. Allt är fullbokat sedan länge.
Vous n'avez pas de chambre libre?
Non, plus maintenant. Depuis plus de 2 ans, nous étions réservés déjà.
Men mitt i allt står hejet inför D-dagen här längs stränderna i Normandie så finns förstås också allvaret och de dystra minnena. Här på den här stranden där jag står just nu stupade tusentals soldater på bara några timmar. Många unga män hann inte mer än ta några steg på den här stranden förrän deras liv var slut. Bara här på den amerikanska kyrkogården ligger 10 000 män begravda. Ännu fler skickades hem i kistor. Peter Albanese från New York hittar namn han minns från den där dagen för 50 år sedan.
Men I loved them, they loved me, we fought together. They didn't make it, I made it. Thank God for that.
Det är alltså apropå D-Day som infaller om några dagar.
Åter om D-dagen från CNN 1 juni 1994.
June 6th, the anniversary of D-Day. D-Day was the name given to a fierce Allied offensive on the beaches of Normandy, France. It turned the tide of World War II against Nazi Germany. U.S. President Bill Clinton will take part in commemoration services. He began Wednesday by laying a wreath at a World War II monument near the White House. And he compared the success of 50 years ago to the potential for success in the face of different challenges now.
Today we face new challenges at home and abroad. We know too, as then, our successes will not come with rushing speed, But we must see our battles through to the end. As it was on D-Day, America will be at work next Monday, June the 6th. For one moment on that Monday, you might pause and reflect. 50 years ago, on this day, at this hour, the men and women of America saved democracy in Europe and changed the course of history for the world. Wherever you are then, I hope you will have some time to look at the ceremonies. I hope you will think about how we can honor their legacy by carrying it on.
Mr. Clinton is now on his way to Europe, where he faces a formidable task. As CNN's Jill Doherty reports, the president has never served in the military, and that could prove a major obstacle as he tries to shore up his global image.
The images of D-Day are burned into Americans' memories, and President Clinton has been building on those images as he prepares for his role in the 50th anniversary of the invasion.
They rest in peace far from home, as do thousands of other Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice during World War II. Buried in American soil overseas with names like Natuno and Colville. The World Wars are over, the Cold War has been won. Now it is our job to win the peace.
But some question whether a president who avoided military service and protested against his generation's war is equal to the task of honoring those who fought in the cataclysmic battle of World War II. Historian Stephen Ambrose, author of a new book on D-Day, says President Clinton is in a very delicate position.
I would urge the president to not make any pretense of being a military man. Ronald Reagan could get away with it because he was in the Army in the Second World War, even if it was in Hollywood making pictures. But Reagan could get to that observation post at Point du Hoc and get down there with Nancy into the emplacement itself and look out to the sea, and it was terrific, and Reagan did it fabulously. Clinton can't do that.
10 years ago, Ronald Reagan delivered one of the most memorable speeches of his presidency at Normandy.
These are the boys of Point du Hoc.
But President Clinton's aides say the D-Day anniversary should not hinge on comparisons.
It is bigger than that. This is about the veterans, not about whether one speech is better or more prepared than another. This is really about them, and I would hope that all of the focus and the attention could be on that enormous sacrifice.
Normandy veteran Donald McKee believes President Clinton will try to do a good job, but he sees a generation gap between World War II vets and President Clinton's 60s generation.
It's still difficult for our people, you know, to fully understand what his thoughts and motives were and what they are now. But he will be accepted. He's not beloved. Let's not say that. But he'll be accepted.
Lieutenant General Harry Kennard was one of the Screaming Eagles, the 101st Airborne Division that parachuted behind German lines at Utah Beach. He says he has no problem with President Clinton doing the honors at Normandy.
Whatever his reasons were for deciding not to take part in Vietnam, I like to think that in World War II, he undoubtedly would have been one of the people in action.
Thank you for your service.
President Clinton has made a concerted effort to overcome his initial rocky relations with the military. His international policy has been under fire at home and abroad, fueled by decisions in Somalia, Haiti, and Bosnia. But in his D-Day speeches, the president will stress larger themes: the victory of democracy, not the defeat of other nations; one generation's victory in the Second World War; a new generation's challenges in the wake of the Cold War.
The stark contrast of Normandy, a single overwhelming threat, has given way to the less distinct threats of civil war, ethnic hatred, and terrorism. President Clinton's formidable task, his aides say, will be to rekindle that same unity of purpose and spirit that brought Americans together 50 years ago. Jill Doherty, CNN, the White House.
While most involved in the war believed a great offensive was due soon, few knew it was to begin in only 5 days. CNN's Mark Left takes a look back at what was happening on this day 50 years ago.
Two
This wasn't yet museum music in 1944. Much had happened since the Japanese attack on Hawaii had brought the U.S. into the global conflict just 2.5 years earlier. On June 1st, the Senate Judiciary Committee gave the Navy more time to court-martial two of Pearl Harbor's commanders, while a U.S. congressman introduced a bill to draft unmarried, unemployed women younger than 35. So many men had been drafted that San Francisco was recruiting women traffic cops on June 1st, a day the U.S. Army counted 3,657,000 troops overseas. Major Sterling Claiborne was an Atlanta doctor treating patients at a field hospital in Algeria. In his journal that day, he wrote that it's difficult not to have fanciful or hopeful thoughts of the end of the conflict, but the pessimists are winning the money right now. One submarine crew north of Japan was in a much happier mood on June 1st. Tokyo acknowledged what USS Barb skipper Gene Flucky already knew, and it was party time.
My cooks celebrated by baking a cake, and they would put a model of a ship on it breaking in half, or the way it was sinking, the sinking that we had done the previous day.
On June 1st, 1944, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was at 142 and a quarter. Across the bridge in Brooklyn, hundreds of people needed medical help when a truck accident sent chlorine gas through the air vents of a subway station. Gasoline was cheap during the war years, but with rationing, not always easy to get. A Warner Brothers cartoon in theaters June 1st used humor as a weapon against both the cause and effects of the war. Other screens.
The Gestapo does not entirely trust you, gentlemen of the Garmobile. You are Frenchmen.
This fictional look at German-occupied France featured Errol Flynn as a criminal with a conscience.
What is your name?
Jean Picard.
There, you see wrong from the start. Don't you suppose the Germans know that name too?
On June 1st, the real French partisans were listening to London for secret radio messages, while the real Germans were training and waiting for an attack.
We knew where to go in the case of, but we didn't know what will happen. Yeah?
And to make sure they didn't know, Allied commanders in England locked the invasion force away from the general public.
We were all kind of in prison, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There was a great deal of security, because by that time we were briefing all of the enlisted men about the landing.
Secret orders for the landing craft called June 1st L-Day. A New York Times editorial called it the beginning of the season that must bring a climax to what it called this greatest of all human conflicts, the great invasion of the European continent from the West. Almost everybody knew it would happen, but on June 1st, 1944, only a few knew where and when. Mark Leff, CNN, reporting.
And this programming note, CNN International will be presenting live coverage and in-depth special reports on D-Day events beginning Friday.
Tredje juni 1994. USAs president Clinton i Italien och talar där om D-dagen, eller alla det som stupat i Italien 1944.
Now our moment for common cause has come. It is up to us to ensure a world of peace and prosperity for yet another generation.
7,862 U.S. servicemen are buried at Nettuno, killed in battles from Sicily to Salerno to the Anzio beachhead, leading ultimately to the liberation of Rome. President Clinton walked slowly through the cemetery, pausing at several graves along the way, talking with veterans who've returned for the anniversary. He was met by four senators who fought and were wounded in Italy, Bob Dole, Daniel Inouye, Claiborne Pell, and Fritz Hollings. The president's own father, William Blythe, served in Italy, a fact the president mentioned in his speech, a tangible connection to a war that ended before Mr. Clinton was born. In ceremonial visits like the one at Nettuno, in his speeches, and in appearances with the full complement of his national security team, President Clinton will be trying to polish the image of his international policy under fire for a lack of consistency on Bosnia, Haiti, and North Korea. Jill Doherty, CNN, Rome.
Fire.
Later, Mr. Clinton and Italy's President Scalfaro visited the Allied cemetery near Anzio Beach, one of the bloodiest battlegrounds of World War II. Veterans gathered to remember their fallen comrades, and Mr. Clinton shared a family story.
I have been told a story by my cousin about my own father who served here in Italy. Back home, his niece had heard about the beautiful Italian countryside and wrote him asking for a single leaf from one of the glorious trees here to take to school. My father had only sad news to send back. There were no leaves. Every one had been stripped by the fury of the battle.
Mr. Clinton honored the sacrifice of the World War II generation, saying, "We are the sons and daughters of the world they saved. Now our moment of common cause has come."
A presidential pilgrimage. Bill Clinton walks in the footsteps of history's fallen soldiers.
The tale that medals tell, stories of life and death from the liberation of France. To our viewers around the world, good evening. Today from Normandy, I'm Frank Sesno.
And I'm Hilary Bowker. Also ahead, a requiem in marble.
All imperfections past, they march now in faultless order, keeping the hard-won heights over Omaha Beach. A field of patterns weaving their many origins into their common destiny.
CNN's Richard Blystone on the monuments of World War II. We are here at Colville at the American Cemetery in Colville-sur-Mer.
And from this location over the next few days, we will be covering the 50th anniversary of the D-Day landings, the invasion of Europe. This cemetery is one of the best-known symbols of that Allied assault on Normandy's beaches. It is here that more than 9,000 of the Americans who died in the 1944 battles are buried. The commemoration of the historic events of a half century ago promises to make history of its own. A throng of heads of state and government will take part in the planned ceremonies. They will join thousands of veterans and tourists who will also come to remember what General Dwight Eisenhower called this great and noble undertaking. In this cemetery, overlooking Omaha Beach, President Bill Clinton will make the major address of his D-Day tour.
And it was only later that we began to realize how important and how vastly important the success of this D-Day operation was. It was only after we had managed to win a toehold on this Omaha Beach, a little more than a mile inland in one place, and hold it all night, that we realized that, by golly, we had hit the most awesome charge of our life and that we were holding it. This was the moment when you began to realize that the American GIs and their also their supporting arms of any kind were able to prevail over the planners who had done their utmost to make the planning protect everyone, although they knew it was going to be almost a disaster.
Mr. Thompson, there was a moment, in fact, in there when General Bradley fretted that this might end in disaster. As you were there on the beach, what did you think you would be reporting at the end of the day if you were around to report it?
Well, the sense of disaster did not really last much longer than about the first 6 hours. After that time, you realize that the tides were turning and we would be in there forever. But I don't blame General Bradley for being suspicious of the whole thing, because at that time he had not received the word that we had finally made a breakthrough from the beach up a narrow little path behind some German entrenchments conducted by a captain named Joe Dawson of the 1st Division, 16th Infantry Regiment. And he's the guy that led the first troops off of the Omaha Beach on that fateful day.
Rendon Lee, if I could come back to you for a moment. You said that when the landing actually took place, you'd been in so many exercises that this was almost a continuation. But when did you really have a sense that this was not an exercise, that this was for real, and perhaps begin to understand the fact that you were actually making history?
Well, that was quite a time before, when they issued us with 200 franc notes back in the concentration areas back in England. So we really knew then we were in for, it was France, and we were then briefed. We were given the briefing in concentration areas in Britain, and that was, I suppose, towards the end of May, because we embarked around the 3rd of May.
What were the emotions running, you know, through? What emotions did you feel, though, when you were actually taking a part of this? I mean, was it just the fact that you had a job to be done and focusing on that entirely, or did you feel fear? Did you feel elation when you were actually on the beach? What did you feel?
I think possibly, to be absolutely fair, the task which we had to undertake as a beach recovery section, our task was to help anybody on that beach in the same way that possibly you could say the medical corps, or your medics, as you call them, corpsmen. You had a task, you had to look out for other people. It wasn't just looking after yourself. So your concentration immediately was on getting things clear, getting armoured vehicles, using the BIRVs to tow stuff out, hitch on, help if you could to get, when the landing craft had dried out, to get casualties on. There was something going on the whole time, bearing in mind you had to look after yourself as well. But it was a necessary job, and it was helping others and making sure you kept that beach clear, and otherwise you'd have the beachmaster after you screaming and ranting as they used to, because they regarded it just as we did as our beach, he regarded it as his beach, and you had to keep that moving.
Elisabeth den andra av England håller tal vid bankett vid 50-årsjubileet av D-dagen 1944. Men närvarande var Frankrikes president Mitterrand och USAs president Clinton. Och det var den 4 juni 1994.
It's a fragile thing. Events round the world, some of them close to home in Europe, prove that to us day after day. It is up to us to make sure that the prayers of 50 years ago are truly answered by rededicating ourselves to the creation of a world at peace. Operation Overlord was a mighty deed, which proved what can be achieved against daunting odds when governments and people act together with conviction in a common cause. We are right to look back on it with pride and with thanks to God for its success. But we cannot let it rest there. We must keep faith with those who landed on the beaches of Normandy 50 years ago, by continuing vigilant in defense of peace and freedom. This commemoration has brought the past into the present. May it also be an inspiration for the future. Now, I ask you all to rise and drink the health of the other sovereigns and heads of state here represented. Monsieur le Président. Mr. President.
Well, applause there for the Queen's speech, a speech which lasted just over 10 minutes, where she said that Operation Overlord, that was the code word for the Normandy invasion, was a mighty deed in which victory was won against daunting odds. With me in the studio, Simon McCoy, our royal correspondent, she did, as you suggested, Simon, there, bring in the words of her own father, King George VI, during the actual events of that day 50 years ago.
Very much so. It was actually on D-Day itself that evening. He made a speech to the nation where he was saying, basically, we must not forget what has happened in the last 4 years, and particularly the work of young men, British and of all nations, this particular night. And obviously, I think that is the tone. She's set the tone for the weekend. Now, it's the veterans we must remember, and the royal family are going to lead us in remembering them.
And a theme, of course, that we must learn from the lessons of Normandy, that there are still wars going on, even in the world today.
Well, she obviously had her audience in mind. She had President Clinton, President Mitterrand of France sitting next to her, and other very important people in that room. She had a good audience to listen to that sort of speech. Yes, a very good speech from her.
Den 6 juni 1994.
Idag, för precis 50 år sedan, inleddes den allierade landstigningen i Normandie i Frankrike. Operation Overlord kom att bli den stora vändpunkten i andra världskriget. 140 000 allierade soldater stormade den franska kusten under D-dagen. Och svensken Kurt Björklund var en av dem. Som frivillig kommandosoldat mötte han det tyska kulregnet i den första anfallsvågen på Sword Beach.
Det vi blev mötta direkt med kulsprut i eldet, och det var ju många som gick bort, det var de första som hoppade ner. Så man sprang ju i land, vet du, det var ju ingen idé, man kunde ju inte kasta sig ner för man var ju i vattnet, och det var ju bara till att dra sig framöver hela tiden mot maskingevärselden. Det var ju frågan om att hur långt skulle man komma? Man såg ju kamrater trilla man, så fort man kom upp på stranden. Men man visste ju inte om att de liksom försökte skjuta eller att de hade mistat livet allaredan. Det var ju en fantastisk röra.
Och det var hård eld ni mötte?
Ja, hela tiden. Mycket hård eld, vet du. Det var maskingevärs eld hela tiden. Och vi kunde ju inte besvara den, för vi visste ju inte var de kom ifrån.
Hur lång tid tror du att det tog för er att kämpa er härifrån landningsplatsen och de 50 metrarna upp till de tyska ställningarna här?
Det var så fort man kunde springa, dessa 50 meterna.
Hur många föll, tror du, på vägen upp här?
Många. Det var många.
Nu har vi kommit upp till den plats där de tyska skyttegravarna låg.
Här var skyttegravarna här, och då hoppade vi ner, så att vi hade väl en 50 meter fram till detta näste som höll på att skjuta för de som var på stranden. Så när jag kom så långt så jag kunde se dessa, där stod tre tyska och bara sköt med maskingeväret på stranden, de som gick i land. Det kändes väldigt konstigt. Jag hade maskingeväret. Jag kunde inte skjuta dem i ryggen. Utan jag... Tjom, sa jag till dem. Och det vände så, men då visste jag att gav jag dem en chans. Jag hade ju fyllat mig med bly, vet du, så att jag bara tryckte av. Och sen var det tyst.
Kurt Björklund, svensk krigsveteran som hade besökt invasionskusten 50 år senare tillsammans med Jens Eriksson och Nisse Danielsson på Radio Malmöhus. Och ett längre reportage kommer i Studio 1 i P1 strax efter klockan 8. När D-dagen högtidlig hålls på plats i Normandie idag så deltar ett stort antal statschefer och andra celebra personer. Men någon rysk representant har inte inbjudits, vilket har väckt bitterhet. Ekots utsände talade med en av krigsveteranerna i Moskva.
Jag tycker det är som en spottloska i ansiktet på oss, säger Nikolaj Dakotjajo, 83-årig pensionerad överstelöjtnant, själv veteran från andra världskriget. Man glömmer vem som bar huvudbördan i kriget, fortsätter han. Vem som kämpade sig till segern och till vilket pris. Var fanns de som idag firar 50-årsminnet av landstigningen i Normandie? Hur många år fick vi inte vänta på dem? Medan vi förblödde i slaget om Moskva, sen slaget vid Stalingrad. Först därefter kom de. De förde oss bakom ljuset med alla möjliga förevändningar. Det var lätt för dem att sitta på andra sidan Atlanten.
Нам морочили голову, ссылались на всякие, так сказать. Им было легко сидеть за океаном.
А вы хотели бы, что вас пригласили бы?
Слушайте, я не раз так относится, я не пошел бы. У нас есть своя русская гордость.
Skulle ni ha velat bli inbjuden till jubileet? Med den inställningen som de har skulle jag inte resa dit. Vi har vår ryska stolthet. Och hur de än försöker förringa det eller glömma det, så befriade ryssarna inte bara sitt eget land utan också andra folk i Europa. Det var vi som krossade fascismen, så var det.
Мы фашизм самое разгромили. Вот так.
Visa inte det här att väst och öst, väst och Ryssland fortfarande är skilda åt, frågar jag till sist. Naturligtvis blir svaret. Men jag tror att historien ska ge oss rätt. Tack för samtalet.
Den ryske krigsveteranen Nikolaj Dokuchajo intervjuade i Moskva av Göran Skånsberg.
I England deltog det brittiska kungahuset och den amerikanske presidenten vid en ceremoni med ett par tusen veteraner. Men det land som lyckades vända Hitlers egentliga krigslycka har inte fått någon inbjudan till minnesevenemang.
Redan i december 1941 visade den röda armén att Hitlers styrkor gick att besegra. Det stora patriotiska kriget som östfronten benämns i Ryssland krävde 10 gånger fler tyska soldaters liv än på västfronten. Och Ryssland tvingas betala ett högt pris. 27 miljoner ryssar tros ha dödats under kriget. Men den 6 juni väcker ändå ett speciellt minne, inte minst för Ljubov Solitova, krigsveteran.
Мы примокли, грязные, которые остались живые, самолёты уже улетели. Вот, а нам опять кричать, тревога опять, а мы обнимаемся, мокрые, все грязные. Ой! Когда уже открылся этот второй, мы его так ждали, этот второй фронт.
Ryska soldater var inte med i Normandie, därför kom det ingen inbjudan till dagens ceremonier. Men de flesta historiker är överens, det var i öst som Hitlers öde avgjordes.
Engelsk journalfilm från D-dagen 1944 plus lite till.
Various harbors round Britain, a mighty fleet of little ships was ready for the great undertaking, anchored beneath a barrage of balloons, waiting for the soldiers to go aboard. Final word from captains to crews was followed by a routine inspection. Less an inspection than a kind of good luck handshake. And a service on board in which each man commits himself and the adventure of which he is part to the mercy of God. Zero hour. Following up the first airborne and paratroop landings in Normandy, these British reinforcements prepare to leave. Already we have heard how magnificently they fought. It will be a long time before the full story of their skill and courage is told. Ahead of the landings, Typhoons of the Royal Air Force have the job of shooting up gun positions, radar stations and radio installations. These Typhoons are carrying rockets. Watch the effect on their arrival on the target must be left to your imagination. Thousands of tons of bombs unleashed upon a pinpoint on a map, blasting the defenses and opening the gate to Europe. And far below, under the air cover, the great fleet of little ships marched on. Time had come for the soldiers to go into action. They left the shelter of the Navy, the comparative spaciousness of the mother ships, and crammed tight into those bouncing boxes called landing craft. The only way to land an invasion army on beaches before you have a port for big ships. You may guess the kind of steely cold courage you need at this time. You may be a soldier dressed in khaki and a tin hat and loaded with guns and knives, but you're a man of warm flesh and blood underneath, and men need courage to do a job like this. These men had that. Again, the 9th Air Force went out to smash opposition, not only over the beachhead, but farther in where German reinforcements would need swift movement for the counterattack. And on those beaches, the Allied reinforcements still pound ashore. There were casualties, of course. We thank them for what they have done in the effort to bring speedy victory. Now, the first prisoners are coming in. The first line of defense for the Nazi fortress of Europe. The outposts of Germany. The watchdogs outside the castle of a lunatic tyrant. The final word on their work is that they held the beaches secure. Such a tiny foothold we have gained in a vast continent full of enemy armies. We had done better than we hoped, but there is so much more to do before victory is assured. Pray again, as those little ships go on and on with their brave cargoes of men.